Good evening and welcome to another edition of Reporters Roundtable. We are coming to you live from the Voice of America studios here in Washington. I'm Douglas Impoga, and this evening we'll talk about the threat of Al-Shabaab and the reaction of the governments in the region. And with us tonight is my colleague, Vincent Macori. Vincent is the host of VOA's Africa 54. Vincent, once again, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And joining us from Nairobi is Emmanuel Kisiangani. He's a senior researcher at the African Conflict Prevention Program of the Institute for Security Studies, and he's joining us on phone from Nairobi. Emmanuel, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
Yeah, good to have you on the show.
Sure, thanks.
Thank you very much. And as I said, our topic tonight is going to be the Al-Shabaab threat on the region. And just a week ago, there were massacres in Garissa, northeastern Kenya, where university students were killed, 147. Let me begin in Nairobi. Emmanuel, first of all, how are Kenyans coping? And secondly, broadly, Al-Shabaab is not weakening as people thought.
No, the situation is very disheartening, especially if you look at those people that were targeted, very young students. So you expect people who are looking at their futures at a university, and all of them quite white, down. The figures are 147, although some suggest that they could be actually slightly much more higher. So the situation is very disheartening. But overall, I mean, in terms of the strength of Al-Shabaab, that is debatable. Some people think that they are at a very weak point, and that is why they are targeting defenseless individuals just to assert themselves. But so far, I think the situation here is that Kenyans seem to be uniting in this tragedy to maintain that the country is not going to be weakened by this attack.
I see. Vincent, there are those actually who had misgivings, who said the Kenyan government were warned, at least there was a British advisory, and that they didn't take seriously. What's your general feel on the reaction of the Kenyan government?
Yes, I think especially after the Westgate Mall attack, the Kenyan authorities needed to be extra vigilant. And more important than anything else was to be especially vigorous about collecting surveillance, working with allies like the United States and the UK, and making sure that you act on the surveillance you get. Whatever intelligence you gather, you act on it. If you ask me, Garissa University was an easy target on the hill, waiting for Al-Shabaab. Al-Shabaab just took their time. But that was something that was going to happen. If Al-Shabaab could attack Westgate Mall in the heart of Nairobi and hold people hostage and kill up to 67 people without being stopped until when it was rather too late, how more so a university 120 miles from the border, the most porous border of Kenya and Somalia, 800 school kids in their dormitories with only two policemen guarding the main entrance. What an easy target.
That's right. Yeah. Emmanuel, there are people who had also complaints about the reaction of the Kenyan forces. It took them seven hours, and some even journalists got there before them. What's your comment on the reaction of the security forces?
Yeah, the debate. You know, there's a military barrack in Garissa. They argue that they were there within 30 minutes, but there's a special force here trained to deal with such incidents, the wreckage, and there are conflicting reports. Some suggesting it took them 8 hours. You have cases where actually politicians were flown there, but these guys, some of them had to try and get there by road. So there are debates around their facilitation, given that they have been trained for this specific sort of assignment. So overall, the sense is that in terms of communication coming out of the security agencies, there was a bit of improvement compared to like Westgate, who had so many conflicting reports. But still, there are questions, including sources claiming there is even differences between the different agencies. the military, particularly, complaining that they did much of the work, and then you have these special units, the Rekis, that are getting much of the limelight, when apparently the argument is that they only went in and what they did was to kill the four terrorists. But the military themselves had actually done a lot of the work in terms of saving many of the students.
Yes, Vincent, further to Dr. Kisiangani's point there, yes. Shouldn't people be more concerned about preventing these attacks than coming after the incident and then trying to kill the terrorists?
You know,
because you can't shoot your way out of these terrorists.
Many times it's too late. I mean, they're terrorists. It doesn't matter if it was just one guy holding hundreds of kids in a dormitory. That's a captive kind of target. They're strapped with explosives, as we were told. Tell me, if you're going to take even just 30 minutes or 1 hour to get there, what are the chances that these kids have? This is a situation where, in fact, I think there was a total failure. There has been a lackluster performance by the security officials in Kenya in reacting and responding to this. So the best way would have been to stop it before it happened. How wonderful it would have been if we had that four guys or five guys have been arrested as they were planning to go and launch an attack on this university.
Right.
By the time you get there, once it has happened, it's just too late. It doesn't matter that you killed four guys and paraded their bodies there. We have 148 other bodies to mourn. So for me, it's not such a consolation.
Emmanuel, what's your reaction to this kind of fire brigade approach? Do you think enough is being done in intelligence work to identify, because Al-Shabaab, these are individuals. You can't get the whole group and say they are all Al-Shabaab. These are individuals. And to get the individuals, you need the cooperation of the community. Is that being done, you think?
No, I understand the mechanics adopted by this group, that it is difficult. But certainly, there are issues which are very valid. If you look at one of the guys who's actually involved, he's a Kenyan, and apparently he had been communicating with his families, although the security agencies had been notified that he joined Al-Shabaab. Some of the questions that people are asking is, if there is communication, why did the government not track where the communication was coming from and target that guy? Much more, where you have like the US and the UK having intelligence, people are asking, how come the Kenyan government could not have come up with this very hard intelligence? So you have questions around intelligence gathering, which in my opinion are very valid.
Which, as Dr. Kisiangani says, really, it's ridiculous and ironic that the Americans and the British can have intelligence about people who are within the borders of your country, while your men are not able to gather this kind of information. So what are they doing, especially living in a country which is a target of Al-Shabaab? Al-Shabaab every day says it's going to make Kenyan cities lakes of blood. In such an environment, you expect the Kenyan security intelligence officials to be working overtime to gather information. When did we hear Kenyan intelligence officials or security officials warning Kenyans that there is an imminent attack and so do something about this or just be cautious around this area? No, but we get to hear this from the British. We get to hear this from the Americans. How is it that they get this information? That should be a question that the government actually should be responding to.
And Emmanuel, these attacks, this has been one of the biggest, of course, but there have been attacks here and there almost every other month. So is the government or the security forces there taking the issue seriously, you think?
That has been the challenge. What we have witnessed has much to do with the tokenism. You know, when something like this happens or Westgate happens, then you have this emotional statement. But after that, it looks like we're all going to lull and forget about the threat, especially from a government point of view. The security agencies will argue that they have preempted quite a number, and I understand the challenge that, you know, you need to be right. For security agencies, you need to be right all the time. A terrorist needs to be right only one time. So I understand the challenge, but I think, in my opinion, what is being done is not sufficient, I'm quite sure. Particularly like you mentioned at the beginning, where you eliminate a very key constituency. You know, this, some of these individuals live, operate, if you look at Garissa, they came there, stayed in Garissa town, so stayed within communities. So you'll expect that the community is included in terms of gathering intelligence and preempting such acts. But if you see responses, much of which has been through coercion, but then it actually alienates a key constituency that can be a source of information. So I will argue that the approach, you could critique the approach in terms of dealing with the problem, and also critique even efforts. You know, we have issues to do with our security agencies. The constitution provides for certain reforms, but even the reforms themselves are not happening. So you have quite a number of issues in terms of, say, fashioning a response that could be effective to this group.
Vincent, further to Dr. Kisiangani's point there, the reaction here was Kenya was just go bomb areas there where children were killed, and then harass the Somali community, who are some of them, most of them are Kenyans. Yeah. The same thing happened in Uganda when they Al-Shabaab killed people at a soccer match viewing place. They just go to the area where which there are many Somali residents and then round them up, as if all the community was in the area where Al-Shabaab. Yeah. Is your comment on that?
This kind can of be futile and can be counterproductive. Mm. First, it's reactionary. So this four terrorists or five or ten, we don't know, come in and kill your people. Then the next day, you go to Somalia and say, we've bombed two Al-Shabaab camps. Question, how many Al-Shabaab members were in that camp? How many civilians were there? Mm. If you knew that Al-Shabaab was based there, why didn't you strike them before? Why did you do that the day after? How is it that you had all this information, you didn't act on it? The other thing is, when it comes to how you react to this kind of attack, you want to make sure that you don't victimize the innocent, because then they will not help you when it is important. The best approach would have been over this time, especially since Al-Shabaab started systematic attacks in Nairobi and other towns, to make sure that you include the community in information gathering, make sure that they feel they're safe in that country and that they're not victims of security agencies, and then they can help you to, you know, tell you more about who may be involved in terrorist activities. Right now, the Foreign Affairs Minister, Amina Mohammed, said something that is really important. She said the government is going to start gathering information and putting out a list of, those Kenyans who may have joined Al-Shabaab or were suspected to have joined Al-Shabaab. This list should have been compiled a long time ago. How are they going to do it? What is the methodology? How do you do this without alienating anybody? How don't you victimize? How do you avoid victimizing innocent people just because perhaps they're of Somali extraction? Another small point I wanted to make is, remember, when you're going to bomb people in Somalia and then you realize that so many of the people who have been involved in the attacks are actually resident in Kenya.
They're Kenyan citizens.
Some are Kenyan citizens.
Yes.
How much have you achieved by bombing some two camps in or some two villages in Somalia when there could be hundreds of them right in the country, in the cities of Kenya?
I see. Well, gentlemen, let's take a short break. And when we come back to continue our discussion of the Al-Shabaab latest attacks and the reaction of the governments in the region, we'll look at how the militant group may be actually achieving its purpose of dividing people along religious lines.
Hello, Africa. This is James Barty, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on The Voice of America.
Welcome back. In case you're just tuning in, you are listening to Reporters Roundtable, and we are coming to you live from the Voice of America studios here in Washington. Tonight, we are discussing the threat of Al-Shabaab. Our panelists are my colleague here, Vincent Makori, host of VOA's Africa 54, and Dr. Emmanuel Kisiangani of the Institute for Security Studies, and I'm your host, Douglas Impoga, here in Studio 9. Now, gentlemen, let's first, before we move on to the next topic, let's talk about this reaction. After these attacks, on April 4th, the government in Kenya published a list of entities suspected to be associated with Al-Shabaab, including 13 of the largest Somali-operated money transfer companies working in Kenya. And Kenya, as you know, has 2.5 million citizens who are of Somali ethnicity. It hosts almost 500,000 Somali refugees. Dadaab is the largest refugee camp on earth, is home to almost 400,000 refugees. How would this not look like targeting this minority group?
Well, if I may chip in on that. First, it's a big challenge. We know that the similar action has been taken in the United States. Similar action has been taken in Europe, particularly in the UK. The idea is that terrorist organizations use this money transfer remittance agencies to send money both ways to support terrorist activities. But, of course, it's sometimes very hard to tell who has been sending money through which agency. And it can be a very, very devastating action against millions or hundreds of thousands of people who rely mostly on money sent from elsewhere for survival. An example, many of the Somalis in the northeastern Kenya refugee camps who are in their thousands. We have a camp there of close to 500,000 people. They rely on money sent to them by relatives in the United States and elsewhere. And these agencies are easier to access because they have their offices, their locations right closer there to where those people are. If you shut them down, what you're first creating is that sense of animosity because there is potential starvation. Some of these people have no other source of income. And you're making things so complicated in that the resentment may actually make people unwilling to cooperate with the government just because they feel you're targeting them for actions that they had nothing to do with.
Emmanuel, how is that not maybe aiding in recruitment? Because some of them, when they get so desperate, they are easy targets for terrorists to recruit.
I mean, in terms of the issue that you've referred, it is a double-edged sword. We know there's money certainly coming in from charity organizations in the Middle East and other places from the diaspora. But these individuals also get do tax Somalis in areas that they control. So, like, I mean, Makori observed, it's a double-edged sword because you have so many innocent people that do use this facility, given their own context where they rely on people in the diaspora. So unless you're strategic enough, you know, which ones are actually specifically used to send money, which is quite difficult, I'm sure, literally each and everyone out there will use those channels. So it's very difficult, like he said, it reinforces these historical perceptions that the government, especially Kenya, the perception that possibly they're being targeted or the government is against them. So if it is taken that way, then it doesn't aid the cause. Although I know that for the government, because of the part of the reaction here, people thinking it's not doing enough, so it has to do a bit of something a bit dramatic to appear to be doing something. So the question is whether what it is doing is right or not. I think that is the question. But in terms of, I mean, in my opinion, whether that will work, I think it is debatable. We've seen it being applied elsewhere. I'm not sure whether the extent to which it has actually helped to address the problem of radicalization or to limit activities of these violent extremists.
I see.
Yeah. And you know, if you ask me, this is something that would have been a subject of very careful study. First, there could have been a process where you could possibly identify a few of these money transfer agencies that have been suspected of being conduits of money coming from terrorist organizations. And that should have been made public way early, somewhere, sometime back, perhaps. But to do this the day after an attack, first, one wonders, are you just reacting and targeting a particular community, or is this something that you've been working on? I don't know. I don't have all the information, but I wanted, actually, I did call the principal secretary, the Minister of Finance. I wanted to know, is this something that you've been working on for a long time, or are you just reacting to what happened in Garissa? Because if you react, it may not have a lot of impact. It may not really help other than creating that immediate uproar, because then one just sees it as victimizing the Somalis. But again, you must realize that some of these people are actually supported by third-party people. Yes. It may not be the guy who goes to receive money from any of these agencies.
$50, $100.
Yeah. No. There could be someone else who's behind it who has a legitimate bank account in a major recognized banking institution. And so how are you going to stop that? Mm-hmm. How do you identify that person? It's, I think, a very complicated thing.
Yeah, next point is, I'll throw this on to both of you, beginning with Emmanuel in Nairobi. The international media ran up with a story that the terrorists were trying to separate Muslims from Christians. But we later got to know that the killing was indiscriminate. They were just shooting people in the classroom. They didn't care much about religion. But there's that feeling elsewhere that this may be the Muslims are the ones trying to help, finance, being recruited. Do people, Emmanuel, they understand that this is not an Islamic or religious issue? It's terrorists who are trying to kill people.
But in terms of we were just getting information, especially from sources who are there, actually there was this was targeting Christians. These guys apparently went in actually very early at 5:30 because they knew that is the time you have Muslim prayers. So they knew most of the Muslims were in the mosque. And that is when they went to a Christian Union meeting and killed most of us and went also to other places where they were asking them to recite this Islamic verse. So there was a deliberate attempt targeting, although I think initially the government did not want to make that evident because they didn't want to play it out as that. But in terms of dividing Kenyans, you could, if you look online, find sentiments, people trying to think this is very wrong. Possibly they need to confront these people, Islam, some of them trying to project it as an evil religion. But I don't think these are just individual sentiments here and there. I don't think it has come to that point where you have Christians saying they need to take up arms. I think there seems to be an understanding that this is driven by a few individuals who have ill motives, including trying to divide. And that is why you have messages literally here, in very, very many places, people trying to suggest that we are one, we're not going to be divided by such acts of terrorism.
But recent, the forces actually did act that way last time when they rounded up people in the mosques and all that kind of thing.
Yeah. And there was evidence that some of suspected terrorists were actually operating from mosques, that they had actually stashed weapons there. The weapons were taken from those mosques, and some of the religious leaders, Muslim leaders, have come up forward and said they don't condone such acts, they don't condone those extremists in their religion. But when it comes to dividing Kenyans have always coexisted. They don't really have a problem with each other on religious lines. The terrorists are trying to do that. The Al-Shabaab group is trying to do that, but this is why they will not succeed. All the Kenyan Muslims always remember that Al-Shabaab kills Muslims in Somalia. They have no mercy whatsoever towards Muslims in Somalia. When they come to Kenya, they try to take it to from a different dimension, and that is what proves that they have an agenda. They try to claim they're killing Christians because Kenya has gone to invade Somalia. But nobody forgets that they kill Somalis in Somalia. Why do they kill those Somalis in Somalia who are fellow Muslims, people who speak the same language and who look like them? So there, if you look at it carefully, and if the politicians and Kenyans actually discuss openly, it is very easy to discount the agenda of Al-Shabaab in Kenya. It doesn't succeed. If you look at it closely, you realize they have an agenda. They're trying to divide. They really are trying to divide Kenyans along religious lines, but I don't think they can succeed.
So, Emmanuel, as we wind up our program, what's the way forward? What must Kenyan do? And not only Kenya, maybe the countries there that are neighboring there. What's the major thing they should do to curb this threat?
Solomon, on a train, and sometimes it's not clear. But like we have emphasized, we know that there are certain actors in the international community that have infiltrated this group. They have intelligence. That is how they manage to get first-hand information about what is going to happen where. I think our options include trying to do that, given particularly it is some of the Kenyans that have joined this group. So we have to try and improve our intelligence gathering by trying to infiltrate that group. There are also suggestions about improving some of these guys across the border. There's a suggestion about building a wall, although the utility of that is not quite clear. There are debates around whether it will work or not. But I think some are arguing that Kenya needs to approach the UN and the African Union to have the troops. You know, Ethiopia is working very closely with Al-Sunna al-Jamaa inside Somalia to give it a buffer. Mm-hmm. So some people trying to suggest that Kenyan troops in AMISOM should actually be brought to cover the whole of that stretch, not coast, rather than have them elsewhere. So, but we need to just be able to preempt these attacks. Obviously, there are structural problems, corruption within our security apparatus. People manage to get here, and if you have that problem. So it's also about reforms. It's a systemic issue which we need to look at, but we have quick issues which we can do, especially in terms of gathering intelligence and trying to act on that intelligence.
I see.
Before this thing happens.
10 seconds.
Yeah, very quickly, Kenya needs to really get serious, very serious. I don't think the country has been as serious fighting terrorism. Secondly, perhaps the option could be just move away the military that is within inside Somalia and bring them to the border and just protect the border and then fortify intelligence collection within the country.
I see. Well, that's all the time we have for this edition of Reporters Roundtable. I'd like to thank our panel, Dr. Emmanuel Kisiangani, senior researcher at the Institute for Security Studies. Emmanuel, thanks very much for joining us, despite having to tie you down some place in Nairobi.
Okay, sir. It's very messy, but
yeah,
thanks. Let's keep in touch.
Thank you very much. And thanks to my colleague here, Vincent Macquarie, host of Africa 54. Vincent, thank you very much.
You.
Our producer tonight was Bill Wakinjan, and I'll be back again next week with another edition of Reporters Roundtable. A reminder that you can hear our program in case you missed any part of it. All you have to do is just go to our main website at www.vnews.com. Click on Programs and scroll down to Reporters Roundtable. Once again, thanks very much for tuning in. I'm your host, Douglas Impoga, in Washington, and hope to see you again next week.